So welcome to another Zone Show, and I'm thrilled today to be speaking with Anna Isabel, who is a psychological astrologist and analytical hypnotherapist. Welcome, Anna.
It's very nice to be here.
Now, before we start, because what we want to explore today is specifically the time zone, can you just unpack for me what those two job titles mean? Actually, they're probably not even job titles, because they're more like sort of life titles, things that you do and things that you are.
Yeah, it's funny that, because it's very difficult to, when people are talking about astrology, they don't really know what it is. But a psychological astrologer specifically deals with looking at a person's birth chart and helping them to understand what makes them tick. In other words, looking at the life's journey and seeing how they've arrived at being who they are in the present, and what it is that drives them, and how they can perhaps make the best of their potential, and at the same time help them address some of the emotional issues which are holding them back. And at the same time, we can also be looking at what's happening in the present and how it can evolve into the year ahead, and perhaps get an insight into why they're going through what they're going through in the present and how to manage that situation, whatever the situation is, best. So that's the astrology side. Analytical hypnotherapy is, you have a lot of people who call themselves hypnotherapists, just like you have a lot of people who call themselves astrologers, but they're not kind of drilling down into the depth that analytical hypnotherapists would, or psychological astrologers would. So what you get is some people who are using hypnotherapy purely for suggestion purposes, which means, you know, doing relaxation and putting in positive suggestions to perhaps help people stop smoking or whatever it is that the issue is. But although I do that, that's only one aspect of my work, because the other aspect is very important, in that we're in hypnosis doing what's called a regression, which basically means tapping into memories and allowing memories to surface that are relevant to the issue that's troubling the client at that moment in time, so that we can address the feelings that come out of that incident, come out of that memory, and heal the feelings. And that's where the real change then happens. We think that we've forgotten, or that we've, or that the past doesn't matter. It would be ever so convenient if it was the case. But in actual fact, things that are well beyond even conscious memory, like the birth, the time in the womb, sometimes hold great trauma and need to be addressed. It sounds, you know, that sounds quite dramatic, but more often than not, it's incidents that happen when, you know, we're at that preschool age, or even, you know, before the age of 10. Sometimes it's incidents that happen later, but most of the time it's early in life. And that's because, you know, little children don't have the ability to analyze and process to the extent that we have as adults. So what happens is that there's a mismatch that occurs. We get older and we grow up and we become more rational, but we have these feelings that we don't understand, because half the time we've forgotten why we've got them in the first place. And we want to be very rational in our lives, but actually what's driving us is very much the emotional landscape that developed very early on. Sometimes it's misunderstandings. You know, a parent says something to a child and the child takes them literally, or just doesn't understand that whatever is happening is not their fault. That's often the case. But other times it's something more, and the child is being blamed for difficulties that are happening in the family household. Or whatever it is, there's a feeling of rejection. And I find very often that that feeling of rejection is the cause of a great deal of emotional trouble that comes packaged in different forms, whether it's, you know, a phobia, whether it's a fear, anxiety, anger. It comes packaged in lots of different ways. But very often it's that feeling of being rejected that's right at the heart of it. So really it's working on self-acceptance. That's what it boils down to.
Lovely. So those two things that you do then, I'm guessing they must overlap. You know, why do you choose to do both of those?
They do. And I did begin as a psychological astrologer. And what happens is that when you are looking at an individual's chart, you are seeing their life story from the pre-birth period, the time in the womb, through the birth, through that early childhood and the development, and you're seeing how that individual develops. And so I find that astrology is a fantastic diagnostic tool. Very quickly, you can see where the root of an issue is. But it's not enough very often to pinpoint the issue. Then the healing needs to develop. And I used to, you know, suggest my clients have, you know, therapy or, you know, whatever it was. And very often I discovered that they'd already had counseling. You know, they were going through, they'd tried all kinds of different therapies. And I would say to them, well, you know, perhaps, you know, you need to see an analytical hypnotherapist. And then they'd say, do you know one? And I'd say, no, I don't. And I thought, right, you know, the timing is now right for me to go one step further and actually help people with the healing process. And I, you know, I absolutely love what I do. I find that it's just the most exciting thing. I look at my schedule for the week and I see who's coming. And I'm very excited when it's someone new. I think, fantastic, somebody new who I'm going to help. But I'm equally excited by my existing clients because I want to know how they're getting on.
Of course.
So it's a very exciting process.
So for most people then, their experience of astrology would be seeing 12 horoscopes in a daily paper. And then this would presume that a 12th of the population is going through one of those things. So today, if you're a Pisces, you're going to meet somebody, it might say, or something really as banal as that. But this astrology you're talking about is not the same as that. It's completely different.
No. I think we need to make a distinction. It is a fact that many horoscopes that are written are not actually written by astrologers.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a move in the last few years to cut corners where newspapers are concerned. And so you need to be aware of that. And yet there is something called solar astrology or sun sign astrology, which is what we're talking about. And although that is not personal to every Piscean, to every Aquarian, a good astrologer very often can put their finger on the mood of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And how different personality types, which is what each of the signs represents, might be dealing with that mood of the moment. But what I do is much more personal in that it involves a look at the individual's birth chart, which does not look purely at the sun sign. It looks at all the planets and all where they were at the time of birth. And I do mean the time of birth, not the day of birth only, the time of birth. So it's that specific. And the intrinsic patterns that are created by the planets at that moment in the sky and the tensions and harmonies that arrive. In other words, what kind of tune are they playing? Is it a stressful tune? Is it a harmonious tune? And what kinds of challenges do either of those create for the individual? And I think that that's the beauty. And very often, you know, it's a very ancient notion, the music of the spheres. It goes right back to the ancient Greeks. And there is this cosmic dance that is created by the movement of the planets as they each revolve around the sun, as they each orbit the sun. And it's that dance that creates an energy, if you like. And that energy is a part of us because we are a part of the universe. Everything is interconnected at a molecular level. We are stardust. So, and we can see that in a physical sense. The moon has an effect on the tides. That's the easiest thing to see. But we are only just beginning to understand how solar energy affects the planet. And that, I think, is the beginning of an understanding that everything in the universe is interconnected, and more personal to us is what's happening in our solar system and the planets that are there and the energies that are being created as they orbit the sun, come into connections with each other, and so on it goes. And that's what we're looking at, really, when we're looking at a birth chart. You are, if you like, the manifestation of a specific energy of a time and place. And it's how that evolves that you feel it creates who you feel you are and the different challenges that you need to overcome and so on.
I think that's very refreshing, isn't it? That, you know, the BBC is going to start reporting on solar weather this year.
Ah, yes.
Which is phenomenal. And I've been following a site called Suspicious Observers for ages. They do a daily solar weather forecast and how sunspots trigger earthquakes on the planet. And also they're reporting now, and this is kind of a NASA-related thing, how every planet has a magnetic mixing point with the sun.
That's right.
And they're starting to see the mechanisms now by which planets interact with the sun and then with each other. So I'd love to see that. I think for years maybe astronomy and astrology have diverged, but I can see a point this century where they'll converge and we realise that this stuff isn't kind of woo-woo. It's got a real scientific basis to it.
It's a very exciting prospect. It's difficult in the sense that we are so individual and the scientific method is so linear that it's difficult to prove astrology in that very narrow band of definition of evidence. When scientists are looking at evidence, they want things that can be replicated in labs. They want things that can be repeated in exactly the same way. And they are not looking at anecdotal evidence, which is the experience that you and I have in our daily lives. And because we are all so very different, it makes it difficult. We're not lab experiments. I think it's going to take a while for science to understand that anecdotal evidence actually has a value and a worth, and that when I, as an astrologer, make a prediction, I'm not going to say to you, at the age of 25, you are going to have a car accident. That's not what I do. And yet, there are astrologers who are very good at being that specific. But to replicate that at 100% all the time is difficult because you're working with so many variables, so many factors. You're looking at so many possibilities that the best predictions are made when people say, this year, I think your career is going to be a focus. And I sense that there's a big change coming, that there is it's possible that it's a change in the infrastructure. It's possible that it's you who wants to make the change in the infrastructure. Now, that's quite specific, but it also allows the person the room to think and the opportunity to say, crikey, I don't particularly want change, but this is the thing I'm seeing, I can feel it. Most of the time, people already have a sense of what's happening. Yep, I can see change is coming. And then it's my job to help them to prepare and to feel confident to deal with that change. So I think it's more useful, I guess, what I'm saying, when there is a partnership between the astrologer and the client, where we're working together and I can see the themes that are being brought up, and we can then drill down to how to deal with them. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah, because I work just intuitively with people, so I see the future for them. When I'm working with my clients that are writing books, I see the book title, and I see the pages unfold before me. And I've learned not to tell them what they are, because I believe we live on the planet of free will, but at the same time, everything's preordained. And this dichotomy or paradox we can't see when we're in this 3D reality. So I use it as information to allow the process to unfold, but for the author themselves to find those things themselves, if you know what I mean. And then when they find them, I go, okay, that was kind of where I saw it all going, and it means we're in the right direction.
That's right. And that's where I know that astrology is real, is because, for instance, at the weekend, I was teaching a group of my students, and we were looking at what a specific energy, when it occurs in an individual's chart, means. And interestingly, they'd all been through that particular energy at different points in their lives. And they all had similar experiences, not identical, because they're not the same person. And that comes back to what I was saying about evidence. Mm-hmm. You know, you make the prediction and it happens. Absolutely, it happens. There may be slight variations as to how the person experiences it. And that's the bit that is very human.
And you know, I love the concept of time management by changing the way that you think and the speed and you think and the nature of your thoughts. I assume then you could use astrological information to save you lots of time by not doing things at the wrong time, and conversely doing things at just the perfect time.
Yeah. And you know, to a certain there, this is a dilemma, because to a certain extent, that's absolutely true. When Venus is well placed in a chart, when Venus is traveling through an individual's chart and it is well placed in specific areas, that's the best time to go shopping. You will find what you want. And in fact, I had that very thing happen to me this week, and I hadn't thought about it. I had timed my shopping trip according to what was convenient and how I could fit it in. Mm-hmm. But I went and I realized on the way to the shops, oh goodness, you know, Venus today is in a really nice alignment with my own Venus. I thought this is a good day to go shopping. And I found a number of things, but I only really wanted one. And I chose the one, and already it was marked at half price. And when I went to the till, I realized that it was less than half price. And so I didn't plan it. I could, I could have planned it, but on this instance, I didn't plan it. But it happened that my plan was in sync with that alignment. And it worked as I could have predicted it would have worked if I'd thought about it sooner. Hmm. So there is something of surfing an energy. So just like a surfer gets onto a wave, and, you know, to do that, times it right to ride the wave. Otherwise, he's going to get, he's going to wipe out, or, you know, he could easily drown. You can do that when you understand planetary energy. So you can plan things for the optimum time. And you do know that there are times where, you know, you're going to be banging your head against the wall, because this is not what this time is about. This particular time is not about moving forward and doing something new. It's about taking stock. It's about refining. It's about really thinking about your priorities. So at that point, that's what you do. And then that helps you to relax and things go more smoothly. But there is a funny philosophical question. When you say, what is the right time? What is right and what is wrong? And we're back to accepting what is happening at any given moment. Very often we are driven by what we want, and maybe it's nothing wrong with that. It's just that the timing isn't right for that particular thing, but the timing is right for something else.
I got you. So obviously some people might say that going shopping might be a trivial or flippant application of astrology, but I've heard that phrase that millionaires don't use astrologers, but billionaires do. And I'm guessing that with the right astrologer, with the right information tuned into the right question, like any oracle, it's as much about asking the right question as it's getting the right answer. And I guess we're using, like we might use tarot cards to get an answer. We're using astrology not to rule our lives, but to inform us on how we can make a decision. Surely then, in business, you could find out when's best to launch a product, when's best to run a seminar, when's best to have this interview and that kind of stuff.
And there is, you know, there are astrologers who specialize in financial and business matters precisely for that reason. And really, you know, we talk about something like shopping as being trivial. It is, but it isn't, because it's the kind of everyday event that we all engage in.
Mm.
And it's the kind of thing that if we mistime it, makes us get quite frustrated. We feel like we have wasted our time. You know, there's a lot of, it's, we're all very pressured to do lots of things on any given day. And so if we're just a little bit more aware of the energies that are around us, we can help ourselves to relax and time things so that they can go a bit more smoothly. And when things don't go smoothly, we can take a step back and go, okay, so I've just bumped into a glass door and bounced off it. What did I miss? You know, what can I be doing? Is there a more effective way of doing this? And ask ourselves those really pertinent questions. And that essentially is what I do with my clients. When they come to me for a forecast for the year, it's not so much about, they think they arrive wanting to know what's going to happen, but actually they leave with far more important answers than that. Answers as to why they are experiencing what they're experiencing and how best to move forward.
And can I ask you then, you mentioned about regression. We're talking about analytical therapy. You're talking about regression potentially into childhood or even into the womb. Do you go back into past lives as well?
Yes, and that does happen.
And is there any linkage then? I don't know where this question's come from. It's just popped into my head. Is there any astrological linkage between present lives and past lives and perhaps future lives?
There is. There are astrologers who specialize in karmic astrology, and I also work with karmic astrology. Your birth chart is about you, and it holds encoded within it everything about you. And for those who are, you know, only working with the concept of one lifetime, that's fine. But for those who want to understand their soul's purpose, that also is there. And there are clues in the chart as to the kinds of experiences that you may have had in past lives. It's not necessarily, you know, that you're going to say you were a farmer or you were a king, but certainly within the chart are clues as to the types of the challenges and emotional themes that you are here to deal with in this lifetime, and your soul's journey.
And are there certain practical things we can all do? Because we've kind of, the man-made calendar is out of tune completely with the natural calendar. It's out of tune with the 13 moon calendar. It's out of tune with the position of the Earth relative to the Sun at the equinoxes and the solstice. And, you know, for example, I noticed after writing 6 books, I noticed that I wrote them all in spring. So I was kind of springing forward. So now I don't even bother writing a book until the March equinox. So are there practical things we can do by just noticing the seasons and the moon phase?
Absolutely. You see, the way we've been talking about astrology, it sounds very complex and it, and you know, not something that anybody can do. And to a certain extent, that's true, because you do need to, you know, have an understanding of astronomy to a certain extent, and you do need to be able to interpret a chart and so on. And those are skills that you can pick up. So yes, there is a technical element to astrology. But what astrology is really about is being in tune with yourself and your environment. And that means, at a very simple level, we experience this every day, just in terms of weather, in terms of the seasons, and I do mean this literally every day, just the fact that we have daylight and sun, you know, and night. So day and night are part, and we have, as we have become more and more urbanized, lost touch with those natural rhythms. And yet we are part of those natural rhythms. And a lot of our stresses, physical and emotional, come from that divorce. There is a great deal of research, for instance, that gardening is extremely beneficial for emotional and psychological health. Why is that? What is it that happens when we are gardening? We are outside. We are breathing in fresh air. We are connecting with nature. We are feeling quite literally the earth under our feet. Similarly, walking, you know, going for walks in natural settings, that is hugely beneficial to health. We know that. And this is, I think, because we are tuning in to nature. Something else that is about the same thing, having a pet, living with an animal, you know, a dog, a cat, something that you can stroke, again, very beneficial for health and well-being. Animals have no understanding of, you know, 24-hour clocks. They go with their body rhythms. And when we have a pet, very much like dealing with a baby, we are having to tune in to their rhythms and, to a certain extent, having to train them to fit in with our schedules. But, you know, a dog is going to be hungry when he's hungry, and so on it goes. So there is that side of it. What that means at a personal level, I think, if we're talking about practical things that we can do, and it's interesting because I'm doing a lot of work on sleep and improving the quality of sleep at the moment. If you can work out how much sleep you need and make sure that you go to bed, allowing for that time, and allow yourself to adjust in time, you won't need an alarm clock. Treat every day as the same. And I know it you may want to have a lie-in at the weekend, but your body will actually benefit from having the same wake-up time every day and the same bedtime every day. When the sun goes down, we start producing the sleep hormone. The lights change. So if you're wanting to go to bed around 10 o'clock at night, do make sure that you give yourself some unwinding time where you are perhaps turning the lights down, making things a little bit softer, helping your body to tune in to the fact that bedtime's coming. So again, you know, it's, if you work shifts, it's really difficult because you're throwing your circadian rhythm out. These are all things that help us to tune in to the energies around us. That's a very basic one. That's every day. It's to do with sleep. Time we sleep, time we wake up. And then, of course, there's the seasons. You know, this time of year, New Year's Day, everybody's full of resolutions. Why is it that so many resolutions falter after a few weeks? It's the wrong time of year to be doing anything new. We want, you know, in the northern hemispheres, what do we want to do? We want to sleep. We want to hibernate. The days are very short. We feel drowsy. So let's do a little bit of that hibernating, that cozy stuff, you know, when we get home from work, give ourselves that bit of relaxation that we're wanting. Come the spring, and this is you with your books, the days are getting longer. That's the time to make resolutions. That's the time to move forward. That's the time to take action.
And also, I've heard that on a new moon is quite a good time to kick new things off as well.
And that's without even thinking about lunar cycles.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking about things that people can be aware of in their everyday lives. And yes, be aware. You can look out the window and check out the moon phases. And they are still marked on many moon calendars, normal calendars, the moon phases. So you can see when there's going to be a new moon. You can see when there's going to be a full moon. And be aware of that magical thing that is the moon cycle. When it's waxing, you notice that there is more tension in the air. And when it's full, it's like it's crackling. And some people find that exhausting, others find it energizing. Some people don't sleep all night, others can't stop sleeping. You know, it's different people again, different reactions.
Isn't it known that the lunatics come out of the asylum more at full moon?
Well, this is, you know, when I had some time off between university and high school, I did some work for the Addiction Research Foundation in Toronto. I was doing some volunteer work. And I was told, full moons, we are inundated. And at the time, I knew nothing about astrology. I thought that was a bit odd. When I became a teacher, by this point, of course, I was an astrologer. And I could see it. Full moons, the children were just so much more hyper. And if you know the sign that the moon is in, you can pretty easily watch the children who are going to be the most likely candidates for trouble that day and help them, support them so that, you know, because they're going to be feeling more emotional. You know it. You can support them. So you can see that a Sussex police a few years ago announced that because statistically they realized that there were more incidents around the time of the full moon, they were going to be putting out more police around that time on the streets. So again, it's anecdotal evidence.
But the police are doing it, the vintners are doing it, they're doing biodynamic planting and this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you've got to do something at a certain time, why not just back the odds slightly in your favour?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Anna, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you today. I wish we had more time. We could speak for hours and hours and hours. But how would people, if they want to get hold of you either for the hypnotherapy or for the astrology, what's the best place to get hold of you?
They can contact me via two websites. The first one is www.lifeastrologer.com. And the second one is www.lifehypnosis.net.
And I'll put both links underneath the podcast, so thanks for that. But I must ask you one question as well. This is slightly at odds, but so I know I'm going to write this book on the 21st of March, and I'm researching it now, so I'll do this research now. But while I was away for a couple of weeks, three books came in, and I don't know which of the three books to write first. So can astrology help with that kind of decision?
It can, but I would say something that before you do that, before you even think about it from an astrological perspective, I would say, what is your gut pulling you? What direction is your gut pulling you in?
Thank you very much for that. We will leave it there. And I think we should have another conversation shortly about gut instincts and how when our head and our heart and our gut are in alignment, we're unstoppable. How does that sound?
That sounds like a fantastic idea.
It's a date. We'll speak again soon. Thank you so much, Anna. So a fascinating view of time and being in the time zone there from Anna Isabel. I thought it might give you some context if we listen to the chapter from the audio version of the book The Zone called The Time Zone, to give you more idea what it's like to be really in time, on time. Chapter 8, The Time Zone. Time is nowhere near as fixed as is thought. In fact, the manner in which we think even affects the passage of time. For starters, not many people realise that the normal human mind is only capable of having one thought at a time. Just think about what you're thinking right now, and notice how the thought about what you're thinking replaces what you are thinking about. You may want to listen to that last sentence again. This means that if you're worrying about something in the future or mulling over past events, you will lose focus on what is happening right now. This means that for much of their waking day, most people are around 33% efficient. I'm sure you've heard the phrase, if you want something done, give it to a busy person. This works because busy people are often masters of focus. On the other hand, though, being able to instantly recall past events and to zoom ahead to events yet to pass tells us something remarkable about ourselves. We all possess a powerful time machine called our mind. More specifically, it's called our minds. In general, when we are in any of the doing or being zones, time often takes on a different quality where we can get 2 or more hours work done in less than an hour. It's almost like the task at hand gets done in whatever time is available. Woe betide anyone who breaks your concentration when you are in the bubble of your own personal time zone. Neuroscientists are discovering remarkable things about the brain and our neurology. Firstly, they can't readily find a clock in our bodies. It appears, though, that our left brain, rather than being the center of logic, monitors the passage of time and holds a sequence of events. Our right brain seems to be every when else. These discoveries can be made by anesthetizing areas of the brain in healthy patients while they're awake, and then observing their perception of time. What's more remarkable, though, is that other parts of our bodies seem to run to different time clocks completely. Our gut mind seems to produce a stimulus seconds ahead of an event occurring in real time. It seems to be running ahead of time by up to 10 seconds. It also appears to be a guide and alarm system for events we should be aware of to ensure our safety and well-being. The speed of our breath, too, seems to regulate and interact with our perception of time. Breathe faster and time speeds up. Slow your breathing down and time elongates, almost in inverse proportion. It's even possible that the speed of your breath could affect your longevity. The giant tortoise breathes around 4 times every minute and lives to around 140 years. Elephants live for around 80 years and breathe around 8 times every minute. Most humans, however, breathe about 12 to 15 times a minute, and our pre-industrial revolution lifespan was around 50 to 60 years. So what seems remarkable about the time zone is that we have more control over it than we might first think. Using simple breathing techniques borrowed from yoga, we can slow down the perceived passage of time so we can get more done in less elapsed linear time. This even works in group environments. By tuning into our gut mind, we can save hours by noticing coincidences, signs, and serendipities. Our gut can also save us time by preventing us from making the wrong decisions. What is perhaps even stranger still is that when we enter the chill-out zone, we can even tune into future memories. This allows us to take leaps forward in creativity that could take us days or weeks to otherwise deliver. Many scientific discoveries are made in this manner. Luminaries like Archimedes, Da Vinci, and Newton were adept at tuning into such moments of prescience. Once we take ownership of the passage of time, we become time lords who are masters of the qualities of the subzones of time. The 6 subzones of the time zone are patience, punctuality, perception, malleability, prescience, and synchronism. Patience. When we get anxious about time, we can become impatient. This can lead us to rush into things or to fret or worry if we or someone else are late. Bearing in mind we can only have one thought at a time, worrying about time is actually a waste of time. A kettle we watch boiling seems to take longer solely because we are focused on the passage of time, as opposed to any other thought stream. If we try and force events outside their natural course, we restrict ourselves and put unnecessary pressure on the timelines. Punctuality. Perhaps conversely, if we are not mindful and respectful of time when it comes to others, this also distorts the timelines out of their natural shape. Fortunately, when you exit the danger zones and occupy the being zones, you will find you are never late for anything. I am never angry if an author comes to see me for mentoring if they're running behind time. It just tells me that personal time management
is one of the issues we need to deal with. Simply spotting this, even without speaking to the client, of course saves a bit of time in our session. In passing, I've noticed that people that don't wear watches uncannily always seem to be on time. Perception. When it comes to our creativity, one of the biggest time bandits are our own thought processes. When our internal and external chatter is loudest, we will be at our least productive. Just try and write something when you're also trying to think about it to experience this phenomenon. When we pause during writing, it's so we can stop to think. When we write, the thinking abates, and it's like someone reading to us. Being perceptive about our state of mind is a crucial step in allowing us to take control of our time. Malleability. Time seems to bend depending on how we're thinking. If we're stuck waiting around with nothing to do, time stretches. If we're active, time zooms by. So we can take control of it by being mindful of it. We should be malleable to events that seem to throw us off course and appear to steal our time away. Counterintuitively, by tackling some events out of what we think is the natural and logical sequence, we can get things done more quickly. When we're in the being zone, it seems there is an external agency pulling our strings. Prescience. Because we live in a world with a forward arrow of time, we can remember events that are past to some degree or other. It is illogical and perhaps a bit crazy to countenance that we all possess an ability to experience future memories. It is known, though, that our gut mind works ahead of our conscious awareness, so this could explain near-field precognition. This is possibly how you sense the phone is about to ring and know a second or two in advance who is on the other end. If we open up to the notion that our future self has information which is useful to us, we can then pick up amazing insights. By tuning in to such future memories, we can save ourselves buckets of time. Note that there's a self-limiting time logic that means the lottery results are off limits, unless, of course, we're already destined to win. Synchronism. By far the best way to truly become a master of the time zone is to tune into natural time. A combination of our man-made calendar, incandescent light bulbs, and central heating insulates us away from many of the excesses of the seasons. We are each predisposed to be more creative at different times of the day and different seasons in the year. If you go back over past projects and map which were the most successful and easy, you will quickly find correlations with the clock and calendar and your productivity. It pays great dividends, too, to pay attention to the phases of the moon, as these, too, have a great influence on our creativity. We can, of course, be creative at any time of day or night, and productive in any month of the year. By noticing and working with natural rhythms, we learn to go with the flow of time and to stop pushing it back uphill. Zoning in. So while we may not be able to reverse the arrow of time, the flow and passage of time can be warped, bent, and manipulated. We can change our relationship with it such that tasks fit easily into the time available. By being mindful of our thoughts and the manner in which we think, we can stretch our perception of elapsed time. Quite simply, we can get more done in less time. When you take up permanent residence of the magic zone, you can save even more time still. In this special zone, serendipity abounds, and everything you need just seems to turn up with minimal effort just at the time you need it. This, of course, helps us save bags of time. And if you're interested in getting more done with less time, come over to my website, www.tomevans.co, and check out the link to Manage Your Time with Mindfulness. This is an 8-week program that completely changes your relationship with time. It's available through Daily On, and what's even better about it is you just pay what you can afford from $1 upwards. And we're just going to finish off today's show with a conversation that I had with Jackie Walker about how we work in the doing zones, exit danger zones, and live in the being zones. The doing zones. Doing zones are where we show the world what we're made of. They are where we perform. They are where we produce. They are where we make waves They are where we find our niche. They are where we shine our light.
I'm Jackie Walker, and I'm having a word with Tom about the doing zones because they fascinate me. And there are various parts of the doing zones, Tom. And I'd really like to understand a little bit more how we work within the doing zones when we're making waves or finding our niche.
When we're doing this, it's largely effortless. We find the thing that we're really good at, and someone either pays us to do that, or we find a groove in which we work. So when we're in the doing zones, we rarely give it some thought that we're in the zones at all. We're just doing what we love and doing it naturally.
So would it be fair to say that when we're in the doing zone, fully in the doing zone, we might not realise we were in it until we're out of it?
That's one of the problems, yeah. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, to describe the state that we're in, this state when we're performing at our peak, we're being superbly creative, everything happens in time. We're also learning, so we're learning new things, which keeps us going. And we're also making all the right decisions, so we never put a foot wrong.
Ah, right. And in the doing zone, the wheels are all on and we're zooming along quite happily. And if we suddenly put too much effort in and try too hard, we're probably pushing ourselves out of the doing zone.
That can happen, yeah, indeed. Or what can happen? We can just do one bad performance. We can get one bad review for a book. We can do a talk or something where the audience doesn't quite engage. And that can have the result of us ending up in one of the danger zones. So this is kind of why the book is written in that order of doing, danger and being.
Which makes absolute sense. I love that. Okay. And in order to fully work in this doing zone, we must just allow flow and ease to enter our lives.
Yeah, but also get to what is called unconscious competence. So that the thing that we're doing, we are so practiced at it, we're so adept at it, and we're so naturally in our groove, is that we don't have to think about the mechanics of the art or the performance. We can just do. And that just takes time. And so obviously one of the things that could happen is if we did have a setback, that could put us off from doing it. When actually the real thing we've got to do is to get back on that horse and climb that mountain again. If we did take a tumble. For example, a magician might write the first album and get great critical praise for it, but then have an issue creating the second album under a contractual period, under unnatural pressure.
Yeah, that interesting you mentioned that, unnatural, because I would have thought that your course bending time would tie in really well with the doing zone.
Well, indeed, the time zone is one of the zones that I explore in this first section of the book. And being in sync, being in natural time, and there's a module in Bending Time on natural time and how the man-made calendar puts some natural pressure on us, and that might be the tax year as well, so for some people. but getting into natural time, finding the times of the day that were most productive is really key, finding the seasons of the year when we're most productive. It was no accident that I started writing the zone on the equinox on the 21st of March, and it was no accident that it was published by the summer solstice.
Exactly. Yes, you have your time zones well sorted, don't you?
But yeah, but it took me 6 years to realise that I wrote all my books in spring before I actually went, oh yeah, that's when I should write a book.
Well, benefit of hindsight, it's great, isn't it?
2020 hindsight is one of the key attributes to be in the doing zones.
Exactly. So we start to look back and we recognise we were there, and then we can rinse, repeat and do it again once we know that we were there.
Oh, what a lovely metaphor. You've almost given me the title for another book.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for giving us that roundup about the doing zone. I'm sure everyone's looking forward to entering into it very quickly.
Thank you so much, Jackie.
Danger zones. Danger zones are where we come off the rails. They are where life gets tough. They are where the world seems out to get us. They are where we suffer unduly. They are where we blame others. They make us question the point of everything.
I'm Jackie Walker with Tom Evans, And we're looking at the danger zones. Now, Tom, I would have thought that the first thing that people would want is to know how to exit a danger zone, because they really don't want to be in one, I would have thought. It's not a nice, comfortable place. I'm assuming that you get into a danger zone by coming out of a doing zone.
Not all the time. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes you might be doing something you're passionate about and doing the job that you love, and you're not appreciated for it. Or you do something wrong, or you make a mistake, or do something not so good. So you can fall into a danger zone when the wheels come off the bus in the doing zones. But also you just have some bad luck. You know, something might not happen as you wished it. It could be that our genes, our education, or our nurture is the cause of it. And of course there might be cultural reasons. You know, the government, religion, and the media often get blamed. Now obviously, one of the factors about being in a danger zone is this tendency to blame others.
Right.
So we might, if we're of that sort of mindset that, oh, it's someone else's fault or it is external bad luck, that's one of the telltale signs and one of the things that can tip us into a danger zone. And you mentioned about how do you get out of them? Well, it's to take ownership of why the things have happened.
Okay, interesting. So the minute we know that we're in a danger zone, we're actually part way towards coming out of it.
Oh, and often you should say, well, thank you for bringing this into my attention, because there's something I need to learn here. So if you do find yourself sad or angry or guilty or fearful about something, then it's possibly a sign that there's something you need to address so you can evolve and move on.
Yeah, and you know, you were mentioning nicely genes and education and nurture. You know, and we can blame them, because we say we didn't have a good start, or we didn't have this, or we didn't have that. And yet, by allowing that to rule our lives, we remain in danger, don't we?
We do, permanently in danger. And of course, there's nothing to say that we can't now nurture ourselves. There's nothing to say that we can't go and educate ourselves to get new learnings. And there's also nothing scientifically that says that genes can't be changed and mutated. And that's not just with gene therapy and all this high-tech stuff. It's thought that our own thoughts actually can transmute our genes.
So by changing our thoughts, we obviously get some form of healing.
Yeah, and catharsis as well. You know, they say that if you change your mind, you change your thoughts, you change the world around you. And it's not as simple as just seeing the world as having a glass half full as opposed to half empty. The very nature of our thoughts and the very centre in our cognitive process of where our thoughts are. So, you know, losing our thoughts from our head and holding them in our hearts is really right, is quite key, which is why in the Getting in the Zone e-course, there's a visualization for activating our heart center.
Wonderful. And I'm thinking, so we've got, when life gets tough is the time to start looking and saying, what am I learning? Any other real key indicators about where people might be right now in order to start to exit?
Well, I think the thing to do is to look at how many of the danger zones you might be in, because often if you are in one danger zone, let's say you're in the addiction zone, you might be guilty about it and also angry about it. So one of the great things about the hexagonal shape of the zones is that we can take any of the danger zones and surround it with any of the being and doing zones, and we can neutralize its effect.
Oh, that's fantastic. And then healing occurs.
Healing occurs, and it occurs really quickly as well.
Fantastic. Well, Tom, thank you very much for talking us through the danger zones. And at least when we know there is an exit strategy, we can start to apply it.
Yes, and we know that we're not alone. This is something that everyone gets into. It's a natural process to go from the doing zone into a danger zone. But there is a route out. There is an exit route.
Lovely. Thank you so much for those words of comfort.
The being zones. Being zones are where we find peace and tranquility. They are where we find purpose. They are where we become lucky. They are where we go with the flow. They are where life becomes easy. They are where we find out why we came to be.
I'm Jackie Walker with Tom Evans, and we're looking at the being zones. Tom, I notice in the being zones that healing is the first of them. Is that quite deliberate. I'm sure it will be.
Is it deliberate? In hindsight, it is, yes, because I think that to get from a danger zone into a being zone, a certain amount of healing has to take place. A certain amount of catharsis has to take place. So it's a natural place for it to sit. But in actual fact, as you go through all the being zones, the healing compounds. So it's not just that you sit in a zone. And it's not like, should I sit in that zone or the other zone? You can sit in multiple zones at the same time. So in the same way, you might end up in more than one danger zone. You can be in more than one being zone and doing zone.
Now, do you know, I think that sounds a marvellous idea, to be in all these wonderful being zones. It must make life ever so much more easy and peaceful.
It is. So the example I use in the book is one of a dating agency, an online dating agency. So if you, let's say you're starting a business from scratch, then you want some of the loving zone, wouldn't you? Because it's about love.
Well, yes.
And you want to find some qualities from the creative zone and from the entrepreneurial zone. And when you read the sub-zones in each of the zones, they give you the values for the business, and they can even give you the copy that you can use on a website or in brochures.
Oh, now that's clever. That's very smart. So this isn't just to do with individuals. This is also to do with businesses.
Yeah, you want your business to be in the zone. And for any business to perform at its peak, you want all the employees to be in zones. That's not to say you're going to create a business full of clones, because you might want some people in the sales department to have different qualities or be in different zones from the people in production or in finance. And so, yeah, the zones are very applicable, not just at individual level, but at group level. And dare I say, also at national level as well. Imagine if we can get the some of the skirmishes between rival factions in certain places of the world sorted out. And if we can get them to chill out a bit more and be kind to each other and to love each other a bit more, rather than being angry and sad and guilty.
Well, yes, absolutely. I would imagine they're going to have to release some of those things, you know, their anger, their fear, and their ego, I guess.
Yeah, their ego, and it all comes back to that zone, the healing zone, isn't it?
It does.
I didn't set out with the book to make it a therapeutic book. It's more about personal development, self-development. But when you actually take all the zones together and then explore the super zones, then we have a marvellous therapeutic tool.
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. So, Tom, actually living in the being zone, what are the keys to that, do you believe?
Well, this comes down to the last chapter in this particular book, because this is going to be the first of many books, and that's to be in the magic zone. And when you're in the magic zone, it's not that you make the world, but you allow the world to come in, and you allow the perfect world to come in for you. You live a charmed existence, you live a magical existence. You can think of things arriving as opposed to you turning up. And the most amazing things that you can never dream of come to your door when you allow, and when you allow all the healing to take place, and when you're approaching the world from a position of love and kindness and happiness. And that might sound a bit trite and a bit passé, but, you know, we've had thousands of years of war and anger and terror and this sort of stuff. So it would be kind of interesting to try that out for 100 years and see what sort of world that would bring to us.
I would rather fancy that myself. And if people would like to fast track their healing, what do you recommend?
Well, this, as I mentioned, this is going to be the first of several books, and I'm working on the next book already, which is the Magical Zone. And that's based on a mentoring service that I deliver called Cube of Karma, or a software upgrade for the soul. And this is a way that we can fast track ourselves into the magic zone and awaken the inner magician in every single one of us.
Absolutely marvellous. Well, I love having myself in the being zone more often than not. And I hope our listeners do too. Thank you, Tom, for explaining it so beautifully.
So thanks for listening to another Zone Show. I've been Tom Evans, and thanks to Anna Isabel for explaining something different about time, and for Jackie Walker for those three lovely conversations about the various zones. So until next week, it's goodbye. But if you've got experience about being in a zone or even out of a zone, I'd love to interview you for the Zone Show. So get in touch through my website, www.tomevans.co. Bye for now.